And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served on the United States in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris. Roger, you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Background Briefing. And were you able to hear Bob Baer?
Yes, and I certainly agree with him. I think this is a very serious moment in American relations with Israel and the danger of an attack on Iran. I think that's it's very serious indeed.
And it's not a bluff. In other words, I mean, how could we be so passive in the face of something that we know is it will be a manifest disaster and will turn back the clock and put us on the wrong side of history?
Well, I think if one looks at the 60-some year history of Israeli foreign policy interacting with the United States, really since at least since the late 40s, early 50s, the Israelis don't bluff. I think Bob is right. I think this is a serious step. It's motivated in part by what's happened in the Arab Spring. I think there are two factors at work here. One, the prospect of democracy in the Arab world is a nightmare for the Israelis. It means that they have no real cooperation, as they've always had, under the table or over the table, with the despots who have generally ruled in the area. That's been a sine qua non of Israeli foreign policy, after all, and it's what the Americans secured by a separate peace with Egypt in 1978-79. The other factor about the Arab Spring, and I think this is equally important, is that they have watched the equivocation of the Obama administration, a series of temporizing measures and steps and statements. Clearly, Washington was confused, caught off guard, did not have a contingency policy ready, was at best ambivalent about losing its own client dictators in the area, especially Mubarak. And Egypt has always has been the linchpin of American policy, either as a hostile country as it was under Nasser, or as a furtive ally as it was under Mubarak, and of course beginning with Sadat. So these two factors, the equivocation of the Obama administration and the danger that Arab democratization eventually poses for Israel, I think pushes Netanyahu in the direction that he's always gone anyway, which is a very belligerent, hostile stance toward the Iranians, and I think he sees his own political fortunes tied to that, as well as believing that, as Bob said, that somehow the Iranians on producing a nuclear weapon will throw the switch and use it.
So just to deal with the Arab Spring part of this scenario, the hopeful part of it, as opposed to the nightmare, do you accept Bob's notion, and it was reflected by the two guests I had recently at the UCLA Hema Forum, two of the organizers of the Egyptian Revolution, that the Arab Spring is spreading everywhere. It's inevitable that these regimes will go and probably will go soon.
Well, I think it's inevitable. I think it's the single most hopeful development we've seen in the Middle East, really since the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and maybe even further back. I think there's a very serious question about the timing of all of this. I'm not sure that I agree with Bob that or his informants that this is all going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. Obviously, all of these regimes are different. What's happening in Syria is one thing. What would happen in Saudi Arabia is quite something else. I don't think that this is going to be a rapid or hurried process, but I do think it's inevitable. I think that, again, Egypt, Tunisia, of course, was the spark, but Egypt, I think the great Arab culture, the great Cairo is still the great Arab city, I think had enormous symbolic importance. And the emergence of a more democratic regime, and that will be slow, too, in Cairo in coming, the emergence of a democratic Egypt with a more independent democratic foreign policy, and that foreign policy inevitably more pro-Palestinian, more activist. They've already lifted the gate in Gaza, which I think had to have set off all sorts of alarms for the Israelis. The Israelis cannot sustain over time a democratic Arab world on their borders, and they are isolated drastically as it is. They're facing this vote in the United Nations, which they're going to lose for all intents and purposes, whatever the American veto achieves. They'll lose that vote on Palestinian statehood, and I think that, again, has enormous symbolic importance.
So the turning back the clock, as Netanyahu's attack on Iran would be, there's I suppose in that context it sort of sounds logical, even though it will be a disaster for the United States.
It'll be a disaster for the United States and in the long run for Israel, but I think this is really, Ian, a roll of the dice, a great gamble. I think the Israelis have a doomsday approach to international affairs as it is. We've known that for some time, and I think they reckon that they can change the landscape of geopolitics in the region and in the world. They feel they did that in the 1967 war. I was there in the White House in 1967. I saw the way the administration reacted to all of that, the run up to the war. And we're going to see a similar reaction, I think, in the Obama administration. This could be stopped, as Bob suggested, by something categorical, by the president acting in a categorical way, but that's highly unlikely. His habit here, his tendency is to be ambivalent and to temporize in these matters. He's surrounded, of course, as you well know, by what I would call effectively a kind of sixth column, if not a fifth column of active agents, a sixth column of people who are so sympathetic to the Israelis as to shut out serious consideration of another policy. And that's not just Dennis Ross, the Israeli lobby sort of revolving door bureaucrat who is the head of Middle Eastern Affairs and the NSC, and not just Vice President Biden, who is a legendary servant of the Israel lobby, but also the new National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, who has a long history of being very pro-Israeli inside the government, back to his days as a staff man for Warren Christopher in the Clinton administration. And you have a new factor here, a joker in the deck, as it were, a new Secretary of Defense in Leon Panetta, who I think has always been, certainly in the Congress and to the extent that he had a voice in the Clinton years, very much a hawk on the Middle East. There's no reckoning here of anyone of any authority inside the Obama administration who's going to put the brakes on this. And so I see Bob's scenario being played out. I think the president will have no choice but to basically acquiesce in an Israeli attack. And from the point of view of the Iranians, we know, Bob is absolutely right, it is an asymmetrical strategy, and we know that they will hit us. They will hit us where it hurts. They'll hit us with a declining troop force in Iraq. They'll hit us in the Persian Gulf. they will certainly respond in Lebanon and elsewhere throughout the Middle East. This is going to be a nightmare. It's going to play havoc with oil, and it's certainly going to be a major factor in the America's immediate economic future, which is none too bright as it is. I don't see this being anything but a short and long-term disaster for the Obama administration politically. I think there are already signs out there which are not very encouraging. He's got very, very weak and wan opposition from the Republicans, but his own base is certainly lacking in enthusiasm. There's a lot of disillusionment. There's a lot of desertion in the ranks, both in financial terms and in terms of sheer volunteer bodies out there. This is not 2008 by any stretch. And so the president's got a very difficult political calculus here, and it's sort of a no-win if he really leans on the Israelis and stops this disaster. He runs the risk of the lobby retaliating as only they can do with a massive effort that could end up electing a Republican who would be almost reflexively a pro-Israeli. So it's from Obama's point of view, it's not a good choice.
So I guess Roger Morris, again, who served on the National Security Council and in the U.S. Foreign Service, on the senior staff of the National Security Council, the absence of Robert Gates, I mean, Gates would make a difference if he was still there. And I understand the U.S. military have made their feelings clear that when Dick Cheney was talking about attacking Iran, not to mention Syria, the U.S. military apparently weighed in. So they're weighing in behind the scenes.
There's no question that they are, and I hate to say this. I think our generals, who have been for the most part, I think, irresponsible in the conduct of the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan, may be our last best hope here. It would have been much better if we still had Bob Gates, for all his faults and flaws in the record. I think he was adamantly opposed to supporting giving any kind of green light to the Israelis. The problem with dealing with the Israelis is that it's almost a nightmare scenario based upon Obama's mode of operation, based on the psychology and sociology of his governance. Anything less than a categorical veto of this by the U.S. government, by Washington, and there are, of course, means financially and otherwise, we certainly could hurt and isolate the Israelis even more than they are now. Anything less than a categorical veto, though, is taken, I think, as a green light. There is no such thing as an amber light that works with Jerusalem, and I think the Obama administration may not understand that. You know, they have no one there with any institutional history, no one there with a longer term perspective on dealing with this very, very troublesome, increasingly independent, defiant, almost hostile client. Our single most important, arguably our most important, certainly one of our most expensive clients in the history of American foreign policy. And in the end, as Bob Baer suggested, they are out of control.
But the people who are speaking out, there's nothing in the American press about this, but the people who are speaking out are the most senior intelligence officials in Israel and General Ashkenazi, the chief of staff of the military.
And I don't think this is any secret within the U.S. government. It's not being talked about. You're seeing a little bit of ripple effect here in Panetta's remarks in Iraq, talking about how active the Iranians were in arming the Shiite militia, and then blaming them as direct responsibility for the recent spate of American casualties there. You're seeing more aggressive Iranian actions everywhere. The Iranians are encouraged, of course, by the Arab Spring, because there is a kind of evolving detente between Egypt and Iran. And Egypt, of course, was very crucial in backing the United States in its policy in Iran and certainly in Iraq and elsewhere. So the landscape has changed radically. The one thing that hasn't changed is the administration in Washington, and if anything, it's changed for the worse with the departure of Gates. So yes, the military, the Joint Chiefs may be our last best hope, and maybe they can present a powerful enough case to give Obama cause for being stronger and more defiant in his attitude toward Israel than he's ever shown in the past. He can do this without confronting them publicly, of course. He can do this very much behind the scenes, very discreetly, and can let them know that the United States will not be supporting this. But I'm not even sure, frankly, Ian, that would deter Netanyahu. This is not altogether a rational decision in terms that we would define. I really think that Israel sees itself in an end game. Certainly the right wing, the Likud, does, and end games are, as we know from two world wars and a lot of other crises, end games are unpredictable.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Roger Morris, I'd like to turn to the assassination of Ahmad Wali Karzai, the governor of Kandahar, Karzai's half-brother. Your new book, Between the Graves, about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and covert activity based on thousands of secret documents that you've culled through. I take it it's still in the hands of censors, right, or lawyers?
It's in the hands of Park Avenue lawyers, which is, I'm afeared, are almost as bad. This is a gangland killing. It's also an event, obviously, in Afghan politics. He was, in many respects, the second most powerful man in the country, although using the word powerful, and his half-brother, Hamid Karzai, the president, in the same sentence may not be accurate. This is a very splintered, very tenuous regime, as you know. The United States is facing this drawdown scenario over 2011 and 2012, in which my assumption is and my expectation is that the Obama administration will indeed begin a drawdown, a pullout, as much for domestic reasons as for anything else. But this is a gangland war. He was the one of the largest drug dealers in South Asia. This may, if it doesn't have Pakistani fingerprints on it in some way, I would be absolutely astonished. Kandahar is the center of Pakistani influence politically, and this is bound to have an effect in the next few weeks and months on all sorts of things inside Afghanistan, on the viability of the Karzai government, of the pace at which the modernization, so to speak, whatever one wants to call it, the training and strengthening of the army takes place. This is a disaster. Again, I think Bob Baer was absolutely right. This is a major setback for American strategy. You know, McChrystal's intelligence guy at one point had almost put a price on this man's head. He said, you know, when you're dealing with organized crime, you're dealing with someplace like Chicago, you have to get rid of Al Capone. And the reference was, you know, getting rid of this man who was just assassinated. But then there was a major reversal in American policy. He's always been more or less on and off the CIA payroll, was on that payroll even during the period of the Soviet invasion and civil war and all the rest. It goes back, our ties with him go back 20, 30 years. This is a long and sordid history, but he was definitely our man in Kandahar. He was supplying information. He was helping to mobilize the militia. He was supplying intelligence on the Taliban, and at the same time conducting a drug trade which was highly lucrative. And we mustn't ever forget that drug trade has connections with organized crime in the United States and elsewhere in Western Europe, who are very powerful forces in American politics. So this is, I think, chiefly a gangland killing, but it will certainly have political effects.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with economist David Ruscio.